Coming up, Kim Lawton reports on the historic visit of Pope Francis to the Middle East. And Fred DeSam Lazaro from Pakistan on why polio outbreaks there are on the rise. Also, Lucky Severson looks at the growing number of Mormon missionaries, more than 80,000 of them.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome. I'm Hari Srinivasan, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Prayer vigils and other somber ceremonies were held this week after the killing spree in Isla Vista, California. 22-year-old Elliot Roger killed six University of California Santa Barbara students and wounded 13 others before taking his own life. Police said Roger had three semi-automatic guns and 400 rounds of ammunition in his possession when he died. In the wake of the attack, several religious groups are renewing calls for more restrictions on gun ownership. Pope Francis is back in Rome after his trip to the Middle East this past week. He urged people around the world to join him in continued prayers for peace. Francis said he wanted his Holy Land pilgrimage to bring hope. He said he received much hope in return. Kim Lawton has more on the Pope's historic visit.
In a trip dominated by themes of peace and reconciliation, Pope Francis made numerous symbolic stops. But there were also spontaneous moments, and those gestures, Francis said, he considers the most authentic. The visit began in Jordan, where Francis stressed the importance of religious coexistence. His presence encouraged the country's minority Christian population, whose percentage has dramatically diminished in recent years. At a stadium mass in Amman, Francis renewed calls for peace in Syria, and he praised Jordan for welcoming more than a million refugees. Later that day, the Pope prayed at the Jordan River baptism site, where many believe Jesus was baptized. Then Francis met with Christian and Muslim refugees who told him their stories of hardship. He urged them not to give up hope. From there, Francis flew directly to the West Bank, a move which angered some Israelis who thought he should have gone by way of Israel. The Vatican attempted to counter the criticism by saying Francis did not want to arrive in Israel on the Sabbath, the Jewish day of rest. Palestinians were gratified that Francis referred to the state of Palestine, something many in the international community, including the U.S., don't recognize. Francis held a mass in Bethlehem's Manger Square, near the Church of the Nativity, which marks the traditional birthplace of Jesus. Once again, he tried to bolster local Christians. But politics were hard to avoid. Mass was celebrated in front of a giant mural with the baby Jesus wrapped in the traditional black and white Palestinian head covering. The Pope made a strong appeal for peace between Israelis and Palestinians, saying both sides had to make sacrifices to end the conflict. He issued a surprise invitation for Israeli President Shimon Peres and Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to join him at the Vatican to pray for peace. Both accepted within hours. The realities of the conflict were front and center as Francis met children from Palestinian refugee camps who described their lives under Israeli occupation. He told them to remember that violence begets violence. One of the most dramatic images of the trip came when Francis made an unplanned stop at the massive separation barrier constructed by Israel as a security measure. Francis stood in front of the wall for several moments and bowed his head in prayer. The final leg of the trip was Israel. Francis said his main purpose was to meet with Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, spiritual leader of the world's Eastern Orthodox Christians. The two commemorated the 50th anniversary of a meeting between Pope Paul VI and Patriarch Athenagoras, which ended nearly a millennium of estrangement. At an emotional prayer service at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the two leaders recited the Lord's Prayer together and pledged to work for a time when full communion is restored.
This is an ancient Jewish tractate.
Francis also met with Israel's chief rabbis, and he visited the Dome of the Rock, one of the most sacred places in Islam, where he met with the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. There he urged that no one abuse the name of God through violence. Another emotional moment took place at the nearby Western Wall, the holiest site for Jews. After praying in front of the wall and leaving a note, Francis embraced his traveling companions, a rabbi and a Muslim leader, his friends from Argentina. Francis also went to Yad Vashem, the Holocaust memorial, where he decried the evil of the Holocaust and vowed never again. Here, too, political sensitivities abounded. Francis became the first pope to lay a wreath at the grave of Theodor Herzl, considered the father of modern Zionism. And Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu asked Francis to make another unplanned stop at the Memorial to Victims of Terror, which honors Israelis killed by Palestinian militants. In response, the pope offered more prayers for an end to terrorism and violence. Observers say the pope's message of peace and reconciliation made an impact on many fronts. Attention is now shifting to the upcoming prayer meeting at the Vatican. Some have dismissed it as a mere symbolic gesture, but Francis insisted that prayer is key to any breakthrough. And for Catholics and many others, symbols can take on the utmost importance. I'm Kim Lawton reporting.
Francis also made news on his way home. In a wide-ranging press conference aboard the papal plane, Francis announced he would soon meet with victims of clergy sexual abuse. He said he wanted a zero-tolerance policy on abuse and revealed that the Vatican is investigating several bishops on abuse-related charges. Francis also raised eyebrows with comments about celibacy for priests, saying, quote, "The door is always open on that issue." Members of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops visited Capitol Hill this week to draw attention to the plight of undocumented immigrants. The bishops celebrated a mass for immigrants and their families and prayed for Congress to act swiftly on comprehensive immigration reform. They recounted the stories of families torn apart by deportations and called the current immigration system a moral issue that lawmakers must address. American Jews are among those condemning last week's deadly shooting at a Jewish museum in Brussels, Belgium. Two of the victims were Israeli tourists. A statement from the Jewish Council for Public Affairs said the attack comes against the documented backdrop of a disturbing escalation of anti-Semitic violence and intimidation against Europe's Jews. The group urged more systematic efforts to address hatred and violence. Worldwide outrage continues in the case of a woman on death row in Sudan for refusing to renounce her Christian faith. This week, Miriam Ibrahim gave premature birth in prison to a daughter. Ibrahim was convicted of apostasy and sentenced to execution after a Sudanese court ruled that her marriage to Daniel Wani, a Christian, was invalid. Ibrahim's father was a Muslim, but she was raised in the Christian faith of her mother. In Sudan, children must belong to the religion of their fathers, and women are forbidden from marrying outside their faith. Daniel Wani is a naturalized U.S. citizen and has been trying to get citizenship for his wife. Religious freedom advocates have launched a petition drive urging the Obama administration to intervene. The World Health Organization has warned that new outbreaks of polio around the world are threatening three decades of efforts to eradicate the crippling disease. The majority of new cases are in Pakistan, where, as Fred DeSam Lazaro reports, many vaccination campaigns have been stalled or shut down by suspicions that immunization is a U.S. plot or is forbidden by Islam.
Slums like this one in Pakistan's commercial capital, Karachi, are the home stretch of one of history's most extensive disease eradication campaigns. Polio cases, tens of thousands a decade ago, number just a few dozen today. But in Pakistan, one of just three countries where the virus remains endemic, the campaign has stalled, if not gone backwards. It's especially frustrating since neighbor India, with similar urban slums and crowded unsanitary conditions that expose children to the paralyzing virus, India was declared polio-free in 2012.
The fact that they've done it is what makes me think that we can do it. If you can put enough boots on the ground and do high-quality campaigns. Because if India can do it, Pakistan can do it.
Dr. Anita Zaidi says it hasn't because of a perfect storm. Epic floods, political turmoil, and religious extremists who fought the campaign with guns and rumors. And there was one more setback, the hunt here in Pakistan for Osama bin Laden, in which the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency ran a fake vaccine campaign to gather DNA samples.
Which has hugely damaged public health programs, not only in Pakistan, but in many, many countries, because people ask all kinds of questions. They now think that the vaccine programs might be actually spy operations.
The perceived violation of Pakistani sovereignty in bin Laden's capture, the continuing drone attacks targeting militants, have made the U.S. deeply unpopular here. And it's helped extremists who've long fueled a rumor that the polio campaign is a plot against Muslims. Businessman Aziz Maimon is with Rotary International, which has spent $1.2 billion over the past two decades and led the global polio effort. He says Taliban militants have stepped up their anti-vaccination efforts.
They issued a ban on polio immunization, which is today also existing. These are the same people who at one time were rejecting it on the basis that it is going to make their child infertile.
The polio eradication campaign enlisted prominent mainline religious leaders.
So the Council of Islamic Ideology now has a very active program, and there is a declaration that the Council of Ulemas has made that says that the polio vaccine is effective, that it's not harmful, and it's allowed by Islam, and the Muslim children can have it.
The declaration of fatwa by top leaders has enabled local imams like Bilal Ahmad to tell his congregants, most of them not literate, that receiving the vaccine is not haram or sinful.
People come to me and ask if it is haram, and I say, you've been taking English medicines all your life, and none of them are haram. So why would this one be?
That may increase public acceptance of the vaccine, but it hasn't made life any safer for vaccinators. At least 22 have been gunned down in the past year or so.
Polio workers, they love to target them, not just because of polio, but because touching a polio worker makes a news. They know that. And I'll give you one example.
You mean they're after the publicity?
Yes, sir. They're after the publicity.
Who exactly is after the publicity? And what publicity do they want?
These Taliban groups. So, this becomes quite an international news also.
In Karachi, workers we spoke to, paid about $5 a day, said they were undeterred.
The security situation is tough all over the country, but this is something we have to do for the children.
This disease cripples children, not just for a day, but for their entire lives, and it affects the whole family.
This is important. As women health workers, it is our job to help kids. Polio teams are being attacked, but this is something we have to do.
They fanned out across city neighborhoods, sometimes accompanied by armed policemen, which has not prevented some attacks.
Difficult as it is for vaccinators to work in the cities, it's becoming virtually impossible in the north and northwest of this country near the Afghan border. Extremist militant leaders there have declared the polio campaign off limits.
For now, the polio eradication campaign has targeted children on buses to and from the no-go region. Dr. Zaidi says this will at best contain polio, not wipe it out. To do that, she says, Pakistan's military will need to take on the militants to allow vaccinators safe access.
If you look at the number one problem of Pakistan right now is terrorism. I mean, polio is just a byproduct of this issue right now. The central issue is fighting terrorism. And if you address the security situation, the polio problem will automatically be addressed.
But there's yet one more complication that we saw workers encounter in the Karachi slum. Public ambivalence. Even as they urged parents to bring children out to get the vaccine drops, even as people in this community introduced us to polio victims who live here, it's not clear if all of the children were immunized.
Vaccinators say they got a little bit of resistance to the polio campaign, but they mostly got complaints. It's about to rain and the shelters are flimsy. There's no clean drinking water. There's no sanitation. There are no schools. For millions of Pakistanis who live in conditions like these, polio is hardly the most pressing concern.
Some health professionals and political leaders also feel Pakistan has more pressing problems. After all, education, clean water, and sanitation would remove conditions that spread the polio virus. But those are long-term solutions. Polio campaigners say a comprehensive strategy to simply get drops to all children could wipe out the scourge much sooner. It would also remove the stigma Pakistan endures internationally as an exporter of the virus. Dr. Zaidi says it's outside pressure driven by that concern and a religious imperative that could finally propel Pakistan to act.
I think the main source of external pressure is going to come from Saudi Arabia, because they are going to be very concerned about the Hajj acting as a magnifier and multiplier of polio cases all over the world. If we don't get our act together, they may easily say that no Pakistanis for Hajj and Umrah, and it might just come to that.
For now, among the millions who travel to Mecca for the annual Hajj or Umrah pilgrimages, Pakistanis must prove they've been vaccinated for polio. And even if they have, they must take yet one more dose on arrival in Saudi Arabia. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSam Lazaro in Karachi, Pakistan.
At a time when many religious denominations continue to lose members, the number of people in The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, continues to grow. There are now more than 15 million Mormons worldwide. One reason for the growth is the enthusiasm of the more than 80,000 Mormon missionaries. Lucky Severson reports.
Off they go, two by two, in search of converts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons. You know some of them. Presidential candidate John Huntsman was a missionary in Taiwan. Mitt Romney served a mission in France. Since the time of its first modern-day prophet, Joseph Smith, about 180 years ago, Mormons have sent over a million missionaries throughout the world.
It is an international church.
In fact, you have more members outside of the country than inside?
See.
See. Steve Allen is a managing director of the church's missionary department, which has seen a huge increase in the number of missionaries in just over a year.
We had 58,500 missionaries in October of 2012. We've shot up to over 80,000, almost 82,000 today serving.
There's a reason for this growth spurt of Mormon missionaries. The church's president and current prophet, Thomas S. Monson, announced last year that young men would now be eligible to go on missions when they are 18 instead of 19, and young women can serve when they turn 19 instead of 21.
God is hastening his work. He's speeding it up. We have a sense that there's an urgency about spreading the message of the gospel across the world. I think it would be very safe to say that this was inspired from heaven.
This is the church's main missionary training center in Provo, Utah. There are 14 other training schools throughout the world teaching 55 different languages. This is a class in Mandarin. The female missionaries are referred to as Sister. After spending 9 weeks learning Mandarin, Sister Rolfing is going to Taiwan.
Well, I've always planned to go on a mission since I was a little girl.
Really?
So with the age change, it just really made it more convenient to get to go a year earlier.
Women in the church are not allowed to hold the priesthood. The young men are. They're given the rank of elder, which becomes their first name throughout the mission. This group is leaving soon for Ukraine. First, they had to be considered worthy of serving a mission.
We submit our papers, which is just a kind of a resume, and then the brethren, the Quorum of the Twelve, they sit down and they pray about it, and they look at our picture and they decide through inspiration where we should serve our mission.
Missions are all about self-discipline. There's an enormous amount of self-discipline out there. No TV, no internet per se. They call home twice a year on Mother's Day and Christmas Day. They communicate by email with their families once a week, and they work hard. It is hard, hard work. 12-hour, 14-hour days.
In this small community in Mexico, you'll find Elder Lopez from Pahrump, Nevada, and Elder French from Utah, walking about 15 miles each day, spreading the gospel to anyone who will listen. Each and every morning, for up to 4 hours, they're studying the Bible and the Book of Mormon. Missionary families from the U.S. are asked to pay $400 for each child's mission. These two work to help pay for theirs.
We always have to wake up at 6:30. We have like 4 alarms just to make sure.
No sleeping in.
No sleeping in.
Week before they show up here, they're going around in flip-flops and gym shorts and T-shirts. Yeah. And here, they're all in white shirts and ties.
Carl Pratt is president of the church's missionary training center in Mexico City. In his professional life, he's a lawyer. The language school here is extensive and can handle up to 1,200 students. Outside the campus is a world alien to many young missionaries. Cultures in this part of the world are steeped in Catholic tradition. Sister Weymouth is from Sweet, Idaho.
I decided to come on a mission because if it wasn't for missionaries, I probably wouldn't be here because my dad is a convert.
Sister Brunsdale is fresh out of high school.
Last year, right after the announcement, I was like, oh no, that means I can go. And then I was like, oh wait, that means I can go. And I got super excited, and I got an answer from God that this is what I'm supposed to do.
Sister Brunsdale is among many here learning Spanish only to go back to the U.S. to proselytize Latino residents. The church is devoting a good deal of attention to Spanish-speaking populations, even when they're in pockets in the U.S.
Are there any countries in particular that you're really zeroing in on, you'd really like to make some inroads?
Yeah, the United States of America, North America. We'd like to make more inroads here.
Inroads like the churches made south of the border. Mexico in particular has been fertile ground for Mormon missionaries.
When you went from 50,000 members in 1963 to 1,300,000 now.
Although the fundamental message of the Mormon church has changed little over the years, what has changed is the packaging. Not that many years ago, prospective converts heard more about Joseph Smith and the Book of Mormon. Today, it's first and foremost about Jesus Christ, which is an easier sell to other Christians, like all the Catholics here in Mexico.
The Mexican people are very warm, very receptive.
Dana Call, a farmer by trade, is president of the Mexico City North Mission. He's in charge of 146 missionaries, like Sister Martinez, a third-year medical student from the Dominican Republic, and Sister Sandoval from Mexico, who was studying to be a civil engineer. She says her mom was worried when she heard she was going to the dangerous big city, but that sometimes it seems people here are more afraid of her.
Some people, when they see us, they run to the other side of the road. Others want to know more.
On this day, they're visiting a member who needs help cleaning her house, also part of their calling. On their way here, they knocked on some doors, something that is not that common anymore.
Well, no, we don't talk about door-to-door, although missionaries are certainly free to do that. But we talk about contacting on the streets, and we talk about mostly working through the members, that the members would invite their friends to visit with the missionaries.
It was a member that referred Elders Lopez and French to this meeting with a potential convert.
We talk to members. We ask people if we're going to the store to buy something. We ask the clerk at the store, or we ask the person working there, who do you know that needs help in their life in this moment? Who do you know that could benefit from having a little more of Jesus Christ, our Savior, in their lives? And they tell us.
The Mormons, like many churches, have seen active members stray from their congregations. Shoring up the wayward is now part of a missionary's job.
President Monson calls it the rescue. Go and get and find those who have strayed and bring them back.
Since 1970, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has grown from 3 million to over 15 million members worldwide. And these young men are determined to add to that number. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Mexico City.
On our calendar, the Jewish holiday of Shavuot begins at sundown on June 3rd. Shavuot commemorates the giving of the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai. Some Jews gather in synagogues and homes to study the Torah all night long. The holiday is also a harvest festival, which many celebrate by eating dairy foods like cheesecake. Finally, author, poet, and civil rights icon Maya Angelou died this week. She was 86. Angelou's best-known work is I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, her memoir about growing up in the Jim Crow South. She also often wrote about faith. Her final tweet, written 4 days before her death, said, "Listen to yourself, and in that quietude, you might hear the voice of God." That's our program for now. I'm Hari Srinivasan. You can follow Religion and Ethics News Weekly on Twitter and Facebook, and watch anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. And visit the website, where there is always much more, and where you can also listen to or watch each program. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, music from the U.S. Catholic Bishop's Mass for Immigrants.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.